Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to BT's Q3 2020-21 trading statement conference call for the third quarter ended 31st December 2020. My name is Sarah, and I am your coordinator for today. Throughout the presentation, you will remain on listen only, and if you need assistance at any time during the call, please key star zero on your phone, and a coordinator will be pleased to assist you. I would like to advise all parties this conference is being recorded today, and I'll now hand you over to Mark.
Thanks, Sarah, and welcome everyone. My name is Mark Liddiard from the BT Investor Relations team. Presenting on today's call is Philip Jackson, Chief Executive. Also on the call for Q&A are Simon Lowth, Chief Financial Officer, and members of our executive committee. Before we start, I'd like to draw your attention to the usual forward-looking statements on slide two and our latest annual report for examples of the factors that could cause actual results to differ from any forward-looking statements we may make. Both the slide and the annual report can be found on our website. With that, I'll now hand over to Philip.
Thanks, Mark. Good morning, everyone. Thanks for joining today's call. Before we get down to business, I'd just like to extend warm welcomes to Rob Shuter and Harmeen Mehta. Rob joined us on Monday as the incoming CEO of Enterprise, and Harmeen is starting next month to lead our new digital unit. At the same time, I'd like to pass on my sincere thanks to Jerry McQuaid for his wise counsel and contribution to BT over many years. As we establish a digital unit and move to the next stage of our strategy, I'd also like to thank Mike Sherman for his contribution over the last 3 years and wish him well for the future. As Mark said, as normal, Simon's here with my other members of my exec team, and we'll be able to answer your questions when I finish my prepared comments. So moving to the highlights on slide four. Third quarter group financials were in line with our expectations, despite further lockdowns, and we are reiterating our outlook for this year, with the exception of normalized free cash flow, where we are lifting the lower end of our range so that the full year 21 outlook becomes £1.3 to £1.5 billion. In the quarter, we made some important changes to support the next phase of our modernization. We announced the creation of a new digital unit to be led by Harmeen, who is joining us from Bharti Airtel. While our leading networks remain at the heart of BT, we now need greater focus on digital innovation, built on a great IT platform to enable the creation of superior products and services that are easy for customers to buy and use. At the same time, we remain focused on transforming and simplifying the business by removing legacy networks, creating more modern and flexible IT, and simplifying our product portfolio and processes. This program will be managed by the new digital entity, working closely with the customer-facing units. Separately, we have created a standalone procurement company in Dublin, a well-established hub for many big tech businesses. This new operation will increase BT's buying power while allowing simpler processes and the introduction of AI technology to drive efficiencies into our purchasing capability. And lastly, we're expecting Ofcom's wholesale fixed telecoms market review statement later this quarter. I will cover our expectations for this in more detail later, but in summary, while we expect the framework to be largely positive for investment in many areas, there are some key points of clarity still needed to unlock industry-wide fibre investment that the country needs, particularly around the Bay of Bet. And we still need to see concrete progress, not just words, from government on the things they can do to support the fibre rollout. It's worth saying again that BT is absolutely ready, willing and able to build like fury and fibre up the UK. But we do need the regulatory and policy enablers to ensure a fair, risk-adjusted return or the pace and geographical mix of build will be impacted. Moving to slide five and progress against our strategic pillars. The first is to build the strongest foundations, improving and future-proofing our fixed and our mobile networks, and also modernising our business. We now have 5G live in 125 towns and cities, providing the widest population coverage of any operator, and the number of 5G-ready connections has now reached 2.1 million, up more and 900,000 in quarter. Openreach has continued to extend the reach of its full fibre network, which now passes 4.1 million premises, a build rate of more than one every 15 seconds in the quarter. This keeps us on track to reach our build targets if the conditions are right. Of course, connecting customers is just as important as building the network. In the quarter, Openreach announced an extension to its popular local marketing and FTTP-only deals. It has connected premises at the rate of more than 10,000 a week, bringing the number of full fiber customers at the end of the quarter to 790,000. We're pleased that many of those customers have chosen to connect through BTCPs, and Consumer alone added a record 88,000 connections in the quarter, taking its base to 686,000. This momentum is important and is expected to continue in future periods. In quarter three, the first copper stop sale took effect in our pilot city of Salisbury. Openreach added a further 51 exchanges to the 169 already announced, increasing the total number of premises which will be in stop sale areas in the next 12 months to 2.2 million. As we build a network and put it for the future, it's critical that we continue to modernise and simplify the company. The work is ongoing across the business to shape BT for the years ahead. In December, Global announced the sale of its Italian businesses, serving public administration and SMEs. Staying with Global, we have removed 30% of product variations in the Global portfolio. And in Consumer, we've been working hard to remove non-essential pricing plans. We're using a new process to simplify the portfolio, and it's taking out 13,000 promotions this year, representing some 30% of the BT portfolio. Slide 6 sets out how we've continued to build on our second strategic pillar to create standout customer experiences. The past 12 months have seen outstanding delivery from BT people across all parts of the business. As a result, we have record high customer satisfaction with absolutely fantastic feedback from our customers and a step change in perception across a wide range of measures. Group Net Promoter Score has now increased for the 18th consecutive quarter, testament to the difference that customers feel our products and services are making, even in the toughest of times. The BT brand is at its highest NPS ever, as evidenced by strong BT sales and churn performance. In mobile, complaints about EE are the lowest of all the major network operators. And once again, EE began 2021 as the UK's leading mobile network, winning all seven of RootMetrics test categories for the second half of 2020. Tomorrow's launch of a UK-first Halo 3 Plus, which combines fixed and mobile networks to offer the peace of mind of a hybrid-capable product, underlines how BT's customers are starting to benefit from our lead in convergence. In the B2B arena, we're making it easier for customers to get in touch. Our new WhatsApp contact channel now has an NPS score of more than 60. Naturally, with end customers relying ever more on their broadband, their expectations have risen. Despite the current challenges, Openreach is working hard to maintain copper and fibre service levels. While quarter three total fault volumes were 9.7% more than last year, copper and fibre repair rates were around 3 percentage points better. And in the quarter, almost 90% of customers were offered a first appointment within 10 days, up more than 9 percentage points on the prior year. Turning to slide 7. We Connect for Good is BT's purpose, and it guides what we do as a business, as well as being key to leading the way to a bright, sustainable future. We set this out during the quarter at our Digital Impact and Sustainability Briefing, which many of you attended. But we'll be measured by actions rather than words. And in November, BT reached the milestone of sourcing 100% of its electricity worldwide from renewables. At the same time, we announced our ambition to move all of Openreach 28,000 vehicles to electric power by 2030. Of course, all of our strategic progress is being made whilst we work to respond to the COVID-19 pandemic. and I'm extremely proud of the way in which the whole BT team has stepped up. We've kept the nation connected despite the huge increase in demand. There's been a doubling of traffic on our broadband network during working hours. We've done everything we can to support the NHS, from new and improved connectivity for key locations to direct support for patients, such as our Lifelines project, which enables virtual hospital visits via video-enabled tablets, and staff with free mobile data from EE. And we're looking beyond the healthcare frontline to lend BT support to those who need it most. In the past quarter, we've launched our lockdown learning program with free, unlimited mobile data, Wi-Fi vouchers for schools and charities, and zero rating at some of the most popular educational websites, all to help some of the most disadvantaged kids stay plugged in to learning. We've also launched our Standout Skills campaign. This initiative provides job seekers of all ages with free tips, resources, and advice to help them build confidence and stand out in a job search. We haven't reached the end yet, but I would like to thank everyone at BT for pulling together to help support the nation through this crisis. Now I'll step briefly through the quarter three group financials on slide 8, which, as I mentioned, were in line with our expectations. Overall, revenue in quarter three was resilient at $5.5 billion, down 5%, mainly due to the impact of COVID-19, as well as legacy portfolio declines and divestments in our enterprise businesses, with some offset from growth in Openreach. EBITDA was down 5% to £1.9 billion, driven mainly by the decline in revenue. And CapEx, at £1.1 billion, was up 7% due mainly to the increased network investment. A normalised free cash flow of £480 million was up 3%. This was helped by the receipt of a cash payment from a revenue stream monetisation. This more than offset the negative cash impact of Brexit planning. We remain confident in all our outlook metrics for this year, and following that cash receipt in enterprise, as I mentioned earlier, we are now narrowing the range of our full-year 21 normalised free cash flow guidance to between £1.3 and £1.5 billion. I'd also like to reiterate that we expect future EBITDA to increase to at least £7.9 billion in full-year 23, with sustainable growth thereafter. Now, moving to look at the CFUs, I'll start with consumer on slide 9. Overall revenue in quarter three was down 3%. The pandemic impacted mobile revenue through retail stores closures and significantly lower roaming. Fixed and other revenue was also down as a result of lower sport revenue from the closure of many pubs and clubs. In a very competitive market, we also chose to optimise our broadband pricing approach with positive results on our customer base. EBITDA in the quarter was down 14% as a result of the lower revenue, migrations from copper to superfast early this year, and investment in FTTP growth. We do expect a further impact from COVID-19 in quarter four. The current lockdown means almost the entire retail estate is shut down. All pubs and clubs are closed. We have fewer upsell opportunities and very little roaming. Postpaid mobile ARPU was down 6.9% year on year, driven mainly by the continued mix shift towards SIM only and the ongoing lockdown resulting in lower out-of-bundle usage and less roaming. Fixed ARPU was down 5.8% year-on-year, primarily driven by lower out-of-contract pricing changes, lower copper pricing, and investment in our long-term strategic products, as well as continued declines in legacy voice usage. As I mentioned earlier, consumer has further accelerated its 5G-ready and full fiber basis, something it has done while making consistent improvements in customer experience. Lastly, as a reminder for the 25% or so of customers who would have joined us or recontracted since September, we will be increasing their prices by CPI plus 3.9% in April, supporting our investments in market-leading networks, propositions, and improving customer experience. The remaining three quarters of our customers will see a price change in line with CPI or RPI. Moving to enterprise on slide 10. Revenue in the quarter declined 6%, mainly from lower business activity and ongoing declines in legacy products. Quarter three EBITDA was down 10%, reflecting the lower revenue, partly offset by lower costs, which benefited from our transformation program. We are anticipating an additional COVID-19 impact on trading and business insolvencies in quarter four and into next year. And we are also planning some OPEX investment in quarter four as part of our transformation program. Operationally, order intake was positive, with retail orders up 8% to £3.2 billion and wholesale order intake up 5% to £1.2 billion, both on a 12-month rolling basis. Since the relaunch of our Halo business product last year, 25,000 businesses are now able to stay better connected to their customers when on the move. We've also strengthened our support for SMEs, adding a new mentoring program in partnership with Digital Boost. And we collaborated with University of Warwick and Warwickshire County Council to switch on the UK's first dedicated public 5G network for a connected campus. Lastly, we extended our strategic partnership with RingCentral. This will strengthen our IP voice proposition with new products and services and accelerate the adoption of cloud-based voice products, helping us further extend our UK market-leading position for hosted voice. Moving to global on slide 11. Revenue in the quarter declined 16% and was negatively impacted by COVID-19, divestments of domestic business in Spain, Latin America and France, and mature and legacy portfolio declines, partly offset by a small positive impact from foreign exchange movements. Excluding divestments and foreign exchange, quarter three revenue was down 11%. EBITDA was down 3% in the quarter, primarily reflecting the impact of divestments. Excluding divestments, EBITDA was up 5%. The negative impact of the pandemic on revenue was more than offset by lower operating costs, reflecting ongoing transformation and COVID-19 mitigation actions. However, we continue to see a reduction in our uncontracted spend and a more cautious approach from our multinational customers, resulting in cancellations and delays to purchasing cycles. Obviously, this will impact negatively revenue and EBITDA in quarter four and subsequent periods. However, on a rolling 12-month basis, order intake was £4.1 billion, up 1% year-on-year. During the quarter, we completed the sale of some domestic operations and infrastructure in Latin America and France. We also agreed the sale of selected business units in Italy, which, subject to regulatory approval, should complete by the end of June 2021. Finally, looking at Openreach on slide 12. Revenue growth of 2% in the quarter was driven by higher fiber and Ethernet volumes, partly offset by a decline in legacy copper products. EBITDA was up 5%, driven by the revenue growth. Operating costs were broadly flat, with higher service costs, increased FTTP provisions, and pay inflation, broadly offset by ongoing efficiency programs. As I've already highlighted, the full fibre build is going from strength to strength, and in December, Openreach signed its third R100 contract covering the north of Scotland. This extends a long-standing partnership with the Scottish Government to connect thousands of the hardest-to-reach premises. Looking ahead, we aren't expecting any major trading impact this financial year from the latest COVID-19 restrictions. However, we do expect some impact on FTTP and GFast provisioning volumes, having temporarily paused non-essential work inside customer premises. Our full fibre build remains on track to reach 4.5 million premises by March 2021, despite the latest restrictions. On slide 13, I want to turn to the fibre enablers, including Ofcom's WFTMR statement, which we're expecting next month. We believe that the majority of the framework will be positive for investment, but we do need more clarity from Ofcom on its approach to assessing our returns. Our planned full fibre build is a very significant long-term, more than 20-year investment with a wide range of potential outcomes. Our expected mid-case return is around 10 to 12%, but this return is far from guaranteed. It is vital that BT is able to retain some upside from this level if things go well to compensate for the significant downside risks we are also taking on. Although we have engaged extensively with Ofcom and the dialogue has always been constructive, Clearly, we do not know what Ofcom will put in its final statement, which will be published towards the end of March. What I'm sharing with you now is what we're expecting based on the public statements we have all heard from Ofcom. On the indexation of legacy copper services, the premium for full fibre, Area 3 and switchover, if Ofcom regulates as expected, then overall we believe that these are all supportive of FTTP investment. On commercial deals, it's going to be difficult to sign long-term volume link contracts. However, CP's current appetite for the deals Openreach has in the market gives us growing confidence that long-term demand for the product is there. And as copper stop sales take effect and our footprint rapidly expands, this is likely to increase. We will continue to look at options to accelerate the migration to full fibre, ensuring that we address any constraints from competition law. Unsurprisingly, in a review as complex and wide-ranging as this, some issues do require more clarity. On pricing, we expect Ofcom to confirm the case-by-case approach that requires us to get prior approval for geographic pricing variations and submit some alternative pricing structures to Ofcom 90 days in advance of putting them into the market. Whilst not ideal, we can understand this approach as part of the overall package, as long as the new rules allow us to compete fairly with all our rivals. BT should not have to compete with one hand tied behind its back. That same principle also applies where BT Enterprise, like other players, needs to build small extensions to Openreach existing ducts and poles to serve its customers. We firmly believe this additional build should not be regulated in the same way that it would not be for others. And in Area 3, where Ofcom intends to man dark fibre, this should be done in a way that ensures that infrastructure builders invest in their own networks rather than use dark fibre for FTTP. We believe that government too has a key role to play in helping fibre investment for the country. While government is supportive of investment in the UK's digital infrastructure, the whole industry now wants to see rapid, concrete changes to planning and to give better, faster access to land and buildings. Current restrictions continue to add costs and slow the industry down. And on business rates, exempting the FTTP industry from these for at least 20 years would create a significant benefit to the BT business case. The additional cost of rates is broadly equivalent to reaching around 3 million more premises. Full fibre can help the UK to build back better, and taxing it just doesn't seem to make sense. Given the importance of building fibre at pace across the whole of the UK, we would encourage government to allow an exemption for new fibre to incentivise investment and enable a faster rollout. Without doubt, the area of most intense engagement between BT and Ofcom has been on the fair bet. This is absolutely critical for our investment. Following Dame Melanie Dawes' speech on the 3rd of December, I think it's very reassuring that Ofcom understands and accepts the principle of the fair bet. Ofcom stated that it would not expect to intervene during the investment cycle in a way that hampers investment, and that further regulation was not expected before 2031 at the earliest. The question is whether the statement will be clear enough on translating that intent into the specifics we need. We are making a decision now on a massive fibre investment program based on the risks we see today. And this needs to be compensated with upside kept in play by any regulation Ofcom may impose in the future. We cannot expose our investors to the risk that regulation will be applied on the basis of 2020 hindsight. So we need Ofcom to be clear on whether, when and how they would regulate FTTP prices in the future. At the end of the day, it's for Ofcom to choose what is in the final document and for government to decide how they support full fibre investment. But their decisions will have an impact on the pace sequence, and profile of fiber build by BT and by others. For BT, we are encouraged by much of the regulatory framework, but we do need further clarity, especially on the fair bet, before we can finalise the pace of build and, importantly, the mix between different geographies across the UK. So to summarise on slide 14, despite further lockdowns, first quarter group financials were in line with our expectations, and we are reiterating our outlook, except for normalised free cash flow, where we are lifting the lower end of our range. We've maintained a pace in our modernisation of the business and announced two structural changes which will strengthen BT's foundations in the future, a new digital unit and a new ProcureCo, with the former taking on lead responsibility for systems, process and business transformation. And on Ofcom's WFTMR, while we think the framework will be largely positive for investment, there are some key points of clarity still required, particularly around the fair bet, to unlock the fibre investment the country needs. And we must still see concrete progress from government on the things they can do to support the fibre rollout, especially on business rates. As I said at the start, BT is actually ready and wants to fibre up the UK, but we need to get those regulatory and policy enablers over the line so that we have confidence about our ability to earn a fair, risk-adjusted return for our shareholders on this massive £12 billion investment in FTTP. Finally, we have started to make excellent progress in some of the big issues facing BT. It's good to see our differentiated propositions starting to flow through to customer numbers, and those customers are telling us their experience has been getting consistently better. I'm really excited about the long-term prospects for this great company. So again, thank you for engaging with us today, and we look forward to answering your questions. As in previous sessions, could you please limit your questions to one per person to allow as many people as possible to ask questions within the time we have? So with that, could I ask the operator to please open the lines?
Thank you, Philip. You do have some questions waiting, but just to remind everyone, if you do wish to ask a question, please key star then one on your telephone. And your first question comes from Michael Bishop from Goldman Sachs. Please go ahead, you're live in the call.
Thanks very much. Morning, everyone. I just wanted to pick up on some of your comments around sort of tougher 4Q, and I guess also with a view into FY22. It felt to me like you were flagging in enterprise, you're now sort of taking some provisioning for increased insolvencies. And then there was secondly some comments around potentially tougher trends at GS that you're expecting, again, I guess in line with the recent teaching. And then thirdly, so picking up on the Openreach point around provisioning volumes, could you just sort of walk us through and make sure I haven't missed any in terms of thinking about that T4 impact, and then also just how you think about those things going into FY22 as well? Thank you.
Sure. I mean, let me give you a couple of early comments, and maybe since they're important questions, I'll get Jerry can make a couple of comments on enterprise and Baz on global and then Clive on Openreach. I mean, in general, what we're saying here is, you know, when we were looking at our sort of planning horizon, we probably assumed a shorter, sharper lockdown. We did, and more problems at the front end with that sort of recovery. As it turned out, with all the support measures that we've seen, you know, for furlough and business support programs that the government has put in place, I think it's been a sort of flatter line, as it were. So, you know, we're hoping that will bounce back. But nevertheless, you know, there are businesses that are going to go insolvent that we plan for in the future. So we put that through in our thinking. And also, you know, in general, you know, and Baz can comment on this, in global, for example, many customers are not doing things in the short term. They're not doing projects. They're deferring those things. But the order book for both enterprise and global is actually encouraging. As I said, they're both up across every element. So that's encouraging. And the provisioning volume on Openreach, and Clive can talk about that. You know, we're going to come off a little bit in this quarter because of the lockdown and we're not going to people's homes. But we see that picking up, you know, pretty rapidly post the lockdowns. And, you know, we're hopeful that will sort of start happening in our first quarter of next year. So why don't I ask Jerry just to give his perspective on your question around enterprise and then PaaS and then cloud, if that's all right.
Yep. Thanks, Philip. Good morning, Michael. Yeah, just a few things on enterprise. I think it's Philip outlined, I think we're eking out the trading. Now, definitely we're seeing slower trading, but we're focused on trying to make sure we're addressing where the deals are, making sure that we're not focused on sectors that are problematic. So whilst we're not seeing massive, large deals, we are managing to keep our head above water on a planning for trading by just being much more focused about where the deals are. So, and I think our view is broadly that will continue in Q4. However, the continued lockdown certainly does give us some concern in terms of just how the material COVID impact could be. What you've seen in Q2, then Q3, is that there is increased usage. I think I said in previous quarters that our issue has been largely usage as opposed to, you know, we certainly see insolvency, but it's not as bad as we feared. It's mainly usage of the problem. I think our concern is that we get neither a Q1 effect and a Q3 effect, whereas usage starts to tail off a bit. So with those two dynamics, I think if usage goes off, it probably would indicate that probably the selling would be impacted a bit too. We're also affected by retail potentially going through. But we have got that fear as well, looking just how we provision for that a little. It's not a massive amount, but at the same time, we're going to take the opportunity to invest in a few things. So we are going to try and underpin the fear in Q4 in terms of some of the weakness by doing more marketing. So we invest in marketing. We're also going to invest in some of the digital capabilities, because what we saw in Q3 was that whilst we had the lockdown in November, we were able to offset that slightly by doing more marketing and Black Friday and Christmas deals and so on. So we will do more in Q4 than anticipated. So it's a bit of investment, also a little bit of concern about the ongoing lockdown. Hopefully that answers your questions, but happy to expand a bit further if needed. I'll hand over to Baz.
Yes, thanks, Jerry. Yeah, Michael, just two things, one on trading and one on cash. I think trading, as Philip said, during lockdown, we expect that trading will be down simply because customers spend less on the fact that they're a bit prudent with their expenditure when they're not in the office. We do expect, and this is also what's reflected in the order book at the moment, that once lockdown is lifted in some places in the world, we already see this, and customers come back to the office, there is an accelerated demand for new digital technology where customers will go to the cloud with their applications faster than we normally expect, and will also focus and will not compromise on the security they will allow, or cybersecurity threats they will allow on their network. So that will make a bigger and faster move from our mature and legacy portfolio to our growth portfolio. Now, that will clearly have some effects on our revenue, where that not necessarily means our revenue will go up, but it will mean that we'll be faster in utilizing and scaling our over-the-top platforms. The other thing I would say is on cash is, yeah, there are some customers that have asked for deferrals, particularly in the harder hit industries that we service, like leisure, airlines, etc. But what we do see is that payments are completely in line with what we have in the new credit arrangements. So in that sense, I'm not so negative about the cash effect of this in our industry. Handing over to Clive.
So thank you, Baz, and thanks for the question, Michael. You asked about provisioning volumes in OpenReach. So the effect of lockdown goes like this when it comes to provisioning. The bulk of our provisioning work is on VDSL services, so that's fiber to the cabinet. That work is carried out at cabinets in the street. There is no impact whatsoever on that work through the lockdown period. For OpenReach and for its customers. The portion of the portfolio that is impacted is FTTP provisions and GTAS provisions, and some portion of those, not all of those, but some portion of them, we are appointing into the future. So we took the view early on that the lockdown would start to release in March, That might have been slightly optimistic. It might be towards the end of March would be my revised forecast now. So what we're seeing right now is some of the FTTP orders in particular are being postdated for installation into March and into April. So you'll see an unwind through completions in March and April on orders that were taken in January and February. So that's the effect to look out for. As Philip said, we are not signalling any material change to Openreach trading numbers through Q4. He made that clear, and that is absolutely correct.
Great, thanks, Clive. Michael, just one other point from me, and I'll ask Sam to pick up on your provisions. I'm sure people have questions along these lines. So I think just stepping back a little bit, what we're saying here is, you know, it's been a difficult time for everybody, a lot of uncertainty, clearly. Actually, the business has delivered extremely well across all the fronts with its customers, and the sort of net promoter scores are really, really strong across every division. And I'm really pleased that it's testament to an enormous effort by everybody in BT to deliver for our customers under very challenging circumstances. So sort of tick on the deliver for customers, it's very rewarding in difficult circumstances to get such high praise from our customers. And it's not always perfect. Of course, we made mistakes with a big company with 30 million customers, so it's not always perfect. But the numbers speak for themselves. That's great. The business is under control. You know, the focus on cost has been immense to make sure that we've not spent any money that we don't need to spend to deliver what I just described. We've continued to invest very heavily, build fiber, 5G, all the stuff you know about, such that we, and the way that Simon's managed the cash flow is, you know, is really, really important as well. So we're absolutely comfortable with where we're going to land this year. And I guess more importantly, we're ready to come out of the blocks post-pandemic. So the executive, all of them on this call, spent a lot of time, yes, just planning for the landing this year and delivering what I've described, but also to make sure that we're on track to bounce back when we come out of this pandemic. So again, reassuring you that we've thought very carefully about how we put plans into the marketplace that deliver the 7.9 billion EBITDA in 2023. So that's our focus. But the business is absolutely crystal clear on the plans and crystal clear on the strategy, which is very helpful when you're in the middle of a very difficult circumstance. So I think we feel good about the next few years. That 7.9 billion EBITDA target is absolutely our focus, because it allows us to pay the dividend as we said we would, and also fund, you know, our peak capex levels behind the sort of fiber and 5G and modernisation programs that we are making such good progress on. So, you know, we're cautiously optimistic and pleased with where we are now. You did ask a question specifically on provision. I don't know, Simon, you want to say something on that, and then we'll move to somebody else.
Yeah, no, very quickly. We took additional provisions at the start of this financial year to reflect the risk of increased insolvency, both in the B division and C space for the year. Actually, we've not had to utilise very much of that provision, and so we're still carrying most of it. But that simply reflects our assessment that the continuation of government support has deferred the sharp rise in financial insolvencies. Therefore, you know, we anticipate that as government support is removed, we may find that, you know, increasing, insolvency increasing, but we have taken provisions against that.
Great, thank you, Simon. So I think Morris is next, I believe.
Yeah, hi, can you hear me okay?
Yeah, we can. Hi, Morris.
Great, hi there. Going on just back onto the your comments on regulation and Ofcom. I'm going to be pretty clear in terms of what you want, and you have been for some time. I guess Ofcom did say, I mean, you referenced a speech from Melanie Dawes talking about minimum 10 years regulation. In your comments today, is it more about you just wanted to write that down, i.e. having writing those codes, or you're looking for a more sort of harder set of terms in terms of how they see it, like a higher return or a longer time period?
No, Morris, great question. We want it written down so there's no doubt, because it's such a long period of time. I won't be here in 10 years, and I want to make sure that my successors don't look back and say we didn't concentrate on things that really matter. And when you're making an investment of this scale, £12 billion of our shareholders' money, I need to feel comfortable if we're going to spend it really quickly and carpet the whole country in fibre, there can be no risk for our shareholders that someone's going to change perspective in 10 years' time. So it's exactly as you described, writing down what we think is entirely fair, which is us centrally planning for 10 to 12 percentage point return with a bit of upside should we go particularly well, but obviously the downside we all know because it's a risky exercise. So, Morris, that's right. Write sentiment down so there's complete clarity of how, when, under what circumstances Ofcom would consider regulating in the future. And the final point to make is I'm just looking for some symmetry. You know, we're dealing with a 20-year investment here, so we need to see a regulator who's willing to recognise that and not force us to take a different profile or a different pace or a different sequence because we're uncertain as to what might happen, and we're not going to put our shareholders at risk for that. We can't.
Is QA business rate a showstopper? I mean, I'm sure the government's looking at ways to raise money to fund the COVID-19 as opposed to give away more concessions. Is it a showstopper for you?
No, it's not a showstopper. It's just, I think, Morris, a good point. Ultimately, the government has to prioritise, and we're all under pressure, of course, right? They have to prioritise where they spend the money. It's more, you know, it seems counterintuitive given the kind of productivity gains that are in the business case for the country. And I think there's some DCMS research that there's £230 billion worth of productivity as a result of 5G and fibre. I think from memory, it's £70 billion from fibre. That's not in that case. That's in the government's business case. So in my mind, getting this digital infrastructure there as quick as possible is essential. And therefore, not taxing it would make sense. But of course, they've got to make their judgments to what the priorities are. So we accept that. It just means that we weren't being taxed by definition. You know, those notional 3 million homes which it represents would arrive earlier in the bill program.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Morris. I think we've now got Nick. Hey, Nick?
Hi, Philip. Sorry, do you mean me?
Who's that?
Oh, it's Nick Lyle from Salt Gem.
Welcome, Nick.
Hello, Philip. Good to get clarity. Yeah. On the SME, do you mind if I just come back to that SME point? You mentioned, I think, in your answer to Michael about your thinking for next year. Now, it doesn't sound like there's many bankruptcies at the moment because of the furlough scheme, but that's coming to an end, say, in a month and a half's time. So what is in your thinking on SMEs? And does the approach you've put in place under Jerry maybe change under Rob? Could you discuss that a little bit? And also, how easy is it for you to remove OPEX associated with those SME contracts, because I think Sam has mentioned in the past that the gross margins on those contracts are also high. So could you just run through sort of, you know, what you expect and what you've added into your thinking, please?
Yeah. Well, firstly to say, look, I mean, you know, things won't change massively in terms of direction as we pass from Jerry to Rob. I mean, the handover has been handled exceptionally well and very smoothly. And so, you know, Jerry and Rob would both give you the answer I'm about to give you. So, because we're totally aligned on that. And the first thing to say is, you know, the SME segment is a massive opportunity for BT. And I'm just talking in general over the next few years, with a whole host of reasons for that. What's our approach now? It sort of goes into sort of, I guess, three words. First is help. We're helping them wherever we can, and the SME support program is a part of that. So helping wherever we can right now. Be conservative, the second word. So we're conservative in our planning assumptions because you're right, there will be some insolvencies. But equally, there's going to be a big bounce back. I mean, I think most commentators would accept that more than likely we're going to have a very significant bounce back. Now, how sustainable that is will depend on loads of things. So we see the third word, which is opportunity. We see massive opportunity in the SME sector, but we've got to get the timing right. So expect us to see more new things coming into the SME market over the coming years that takes advantage of the opportunity that is presented to us. So, and again, Rob and I have really talked about that in quite a lot of detail of how we deliver some exciting things into that segment that Jerry's effectively handing over to Rob right now. So a lot of work to do in that. I guess in terms of the, just to reassure you, you know, we have thought carefully and we've analysed very carefully how the market will evolve, and But there is a degree of uncertainty, which is what you're driving at. Of course, no one knows for certain what's going to happen over the next 3 to 6 months as that furlough scheme and as the support schemes come off. But we're hopeful that there's going to be a bounce back.
And on the cost, Philip, I mean, how easy is it to cut some of the OPEX associated with the SME business? If you find that 20% of SME revenue that you're worried about in risky sectors is difficult, can you cut OPEX back quite quickly, even more than the transformation program expects, or are you pretty stuck with that OPEX?
What I'd say is I'm very, very happy with what we've done so far on cost, and I hopefully you can see that, right? We got on it very, very quickly. And the reason I'm hesitating is it's about a balance, because actually the irony is we're investing quite hard now in the SME segment in preparing for the new businesses that are going to come across as a result of the economic recovery, and we're thoughtful and, as I said, conservative on the assumptions, but we're trying to find a way of investing in that segment, and maybe that will cause a bit of pain in the short term because the demand's not there in the first few months. But you expect to see more marketing and more investment into the SME segment to provide what I talked before, which is help and assistance, and there are lots of different things we're doing, because that will provide a good long-term effort. So it's not easy, as you well know, to take out costs in this kind of business in the very short term. What we need to do is keep it under control and plan for it, and that's what we're doing. I hope that helps, Nick. I can't give you a specific answer because it depends.
No, understood. Thanks very much, Philip.
Appreciate it.
Thank you. And your next question comes from Paul Sidney from Credit Suisse. Please go ahead. You're live in the call.
Yeah, thank you. Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
I had a question on Openreach. So Openreach total lines have been broadly flattish year and year for the past few quarters, around sort of 25 million. I was wondering, do you think that despite the likely economic headwinds, competition from both unlimited mobile data plans, fiber challenges, that this sort of line number can remain broadly stable over the next few years as fiber is built out and customers value their broadband more? Obviously, it's pretty crucial that overall line base for Openreach. So it'd be great to get your comments.
Yeah, look, I'll give you a very quick answer and ask Clive to give his view. I mean, the short answer to mine is that we're very encouraged by the line performance, and I think what you're saying is actually spot on. The pandemic has underlined the importance clearly of connectivity of our core business, right? So we've seen more people take up these services, asking for higher speeds and more capability and better Wi-Fi in the home and all things you'd expect. So I think there has to be a perspective that says, if you're in this kind of business and you're the outright market leader, as we are, it's got to be good news. Having said that, the market is very competitive. As the full fiber build takes off, we're expecting a real proper competitive market out there. So inevitably, I would suspect we will see some line losses, but I would like to minimize the number of line losses we have to the very smallest number we can possibly get away with. So, Clive, what do you want to say?
I want to say the following, please, Philip. I think we will see some number of line losses, and that is a naturally follows because of the sheer volume of build by other fixed line infrastructure builders, so the Altnet and Virgin Media. So we will see some line losses, but I'd add to Philip's point, you know, as we move our base to fiber, we will command higher ARPUs, and we will do that because the product is simply superior. It is much more reliable, it's low latency, it supports very high speeds, so I expect higher ARPUs to be, you know, the sort of other side of that coin, Paul. And then I think I would add one final point, which is that, you know, we are moving into a world of ubiquitous connectivity. And the way I encourage my team to think about it is that today we sort of think about it constrained by the number of premises in the UK, which is about 32 million. You know, in an Internet of Things world, there will be many more endpoints than
Very good. Thanks, Clive.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Who have we got next?
And your next question comes from Sam McHugh from Exane. Please go ahead, you're live in the call.
Thanks for the question. I'm actually going to keep it very, very simple. On wholesale mobile, I can see there's some pretty spectacular growth happening in the wholesale mobile business right now. I wonder if you could just comment on whether that's kind of volume driven by Virgin Media, so how much we could expect to not follow through for next year, or how much is being driven by other partners. Thanks.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Sam. Jerry?
Yeah, and just I don't think I'd want to get into specifics around any of the wholesale partners. Just a couple of things I'd say about wholesale numbers. Just given that these do impact competitors, we do give the numbers a quarter in arrears. So what you're seeing is actually a quarter out, so that we don't, because quite often some of the partners in the NBNO give the results after we do, so we've always given those a quarter away. So what you're looking at there is essentially, over 3 months ago. We actually saw volume across a number of partners, I'd say there, so we saw that growth across, it wasn't just one partner. I don't think I really want to say much more than that, actually, otherwise I'll be giving away what they've done in the last quarter.
Sam, is that okay?
Yeah, that's fine. Wasting my the question, sorry.
Thanks, Sam. Appreciate it. I think we're going to John next.
Yeah, good morning.
Yes, John, you're live in the call.
That's very kind. Thank you. Good morning to you. So I wanted to ask, please, about AltNet competition. Just now, Philip, you said that you expect a proper competitive market going forward with regard to open reach lines and service. Given this, could you sort of lay out why it is that you think you actually have a choice but to build like Fury going forward? Given that there is a sort of long list of old nets, well-financed old nets, that would happily sort of displace Openreach if you sort of don't build as fast as you can. Thank you.
Yeah, John, look, that's a really important question. Look, I think you're right. We don't have a choice in one regard, in that clearly, the new technology, the best technology at FTTP, right? So that, the first thing is that we know we're onto something with this technology, and there's a lot of people thinking about and actually building. So no, you're right. We're going to build FTTP footprint. The question isn't whether we do or we don't. The question is how much, where, and when. And so if let me paint a worst case scenario more to explain it, rather than I don't think we're anywhere near this, but. If wording in an Ofcom statement is not carefully thought through, you could lead to unintended consequences. So, for example, if one of the outcomes was very strong competition in all areas, we would not build in certain places because we might be deemed to be too successful. So what we don't want is a statement that encourages everybody to build as quickly as possible all in the same place. By the way, if we did that, I think we'd do extremely well. If we're all building in the urban areas all the time, with Clive's expertise and his team, we do a great job with the cost profile they have, with the expertise they have and the speed at which they can build, and the quality, and again, that's really, really important, the quality of our build is second to none. The cost profile is extremely competitive around the world, let alone in the UK. So we think we can compete very effectively. But the regulatory framework should allow other people to build in a geographical spread way as well. So there will be places where people build and we don't get there, in which case, that's where the line losses might occur. That won't be massive numbers in the scale of our business, but it'll be significant, potentially, for others. So that's what I'm getting at. So yes, we're going to build. We're going to build this 20 million, but I'd like to build it absolutely at full pace and across the whole country and build in those rural areas. And what I'm trying to avoid is an answer that's, you know, pretty good for BT financially, and I think most scenarios will be, but I'm trying to avoid it not being great for the country and not very good if you live in the country. Does that make sense, Joe?
It does. If I may, just, do you think Ofcom would allow you to charge a price which is in proportion to a consequence of your significant market power? Because you would blow all the competitors out of the water if that's the case. So although you're more competitive, will you be able to take advantage of that lower cost base?
No, I think you can see what we're doing now. I mean, look at the, you know, as Clive said, you know, we are, look at the numbers. And the numbers are actually really encouraging for everybody, right? And partly probably because the nature of what's happening and what's happened the last year. But we're building at a, you know, one every 15 seconds. You know, that's massive. We're connecting, you know, double-digit thousands a week. Orders are coming flying in as well. And it's at a price premium. Because it's a better product with a lower fault rate and much better speed and lower latency. So you know, and the central point here, which I think is really, really important, is in the UK, you as a customer get exceptionally good value. I mean, you can get 100 megabits for less than £1 a day. I mean, just think of everyone sitting at home, working, educating their kids, watching films, playing games, less than £1 a day. So I don't think the regulator or the government or policymaker should be worrying about value for money. We're very competitive here. What you can see is there have been challenges about returns in the industry, in Europe and in the UK. And I don't think we should be wasting our time arguing about what kind of returns we make as long as we're in the reasonable category. And I think for this kind of investment, 10 to 12% central case is more than reasonable. And if the regulator delivers what I think, I'm hopeful they will, you'll get a very fast build by us and many others. The country will get the infrastructure it needs. The customers will get exceptionally good value for a brilliant product. And it will increase the productivity of the nation as new businesses and new ideas and new concepts come alive when people realize the capacity, the capability of this new technology.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank you. And your next question comes from Mandeep Singh from Redburn. Please go ahead. You're live in the call.
Hi. Thank you for taking the question. Nick apologizes he couldn't be on the call, so thanks for taking the question from me.
No problem, Mandeep.
So the question I'd like to ask is really on your sort of revenue trend. You know, you sort of, if I compare BT, and I'm sure you guys do benchmarking as well, so if I look at your revenue trends and EBITDA trends, the rates of decline at the group level are, you know, if we exclude Telecom Italia, which has a new entrant called Iliad, are probably the worst in Europe. And I understand that you're one of the few incomes that have invested in premium content, and therefore I understand the impact of pubs and clubs, but, you know, COVID lockdowns, roaming impacts, insolvencies, and so on and so forth are not unique to BT. So when you do your benchmarking, what do you think sort of makes BT stand out as why you have some of the worst revenue and EBITDA declines amongst your European peer group, aside from just the pubs and clubs impact? Is it because you have more legacy in enterprise? Is you have more legacy in consumer? Is it because your prices were too high? Can you sort of help us understand what the sort of puts and takes are and why your revenue and EBITDA trends aren't so good compared to your peers across Europe? Thank you.
Yeah, Mandy, well, thank you for pointing that revenue trend out for us, by the way. I appreciate it. No, but joking aside, look, of course you're right, and of course we totally understand it. We see it and we compare, as you'd expect, to everybody else. So you're absolutely spot on. I'll ask Simon to give his perspective in a minute, but I mean, simply, I think you sort of answered a bit of your own question to a certain degree. It comes down to sort of four main buckets, really. There's the sport pubs and clubs, you're right. There's the roaming, of course, but other people have roaming, you're also right. There's a lot of legacy stuff. And that's very important. You know, we've talked about, particularly in enterprise, a significant headwind, which will roll out over the next couple of years, but also in consumers as we deal with some of the legacy issues there, as you well know. And again, with global as well, right? So there is that. I suppose the fourth point, which I sort of point to, which is really timely, of course, is regulation. Right? And that's linked into the legacy. So, you know, we do have a particular regulatory framework in total here, which has been, you know, very challenging for BT for the last few years, and that leads to some of that legacy decline that we talked about. It's not all about the regulatory agenda, but when you combine all those things, we end up with a revenue profile that you've just described. So, I mean, Simon, do you want to add anything to that?
No, I think you picked up, the COVID-related impacts to which we are as exposed as any, amplified probably by the sport business. We do have still a meaningful legacy voice portfolio, which is running off and getting substituted by digital products. And we're probably a bit further down in the journey than some. We've been very clear about that. We've always built that into our plans and forecasts. We do have the regulatory pressures, and linked to that, we've been very proactive in addressing the customer fairness agenda, and you can see that had that impact on our ARPUs over the last 12 to 18 months, but you can also see that it's had a marked impact on NPS customer experience, churn, and therefore prospects for the future. The final point I would make, Philip, is that we have historically had a significant amount of revenue in lower margin wholesaling customer equipment activity. And we have made an explicit decision to pull back on that business. So if you look at Global as an example, its headline revenues have dropped by more than £1 billion over the last 3 or 4 years. Its profits have gone up. So I think that's the other point I would factor in. The final thing probably to say is that if you just look at the year-on-year comparisons for this year, yes, we have had significant top-line revenue pressures for the reason that we just described, $1.1 billion down. Actually, the profit is down less than $300 million. We have mitigated that very significantly through cost action, and also because quite a chunk of the revenue decline is generating very little gross margin. So,
Simon, really helpful. And indeed, what we're saying here, we've got a trajectory, we've got a path to $7.9 billion EBITDA, and we've demonstrated what Simon just talked about, which is the ability to control our costs, but also early signs of modernizing the company. So you can imagine on a lower cost base, taking out this £2 billion that we've got to do over the next 5 years, 4 years now probably, you start to see the end of these revenue trends that you've just so highlighted. Suddenly you get a different business, and that's our aim over the next few years. Thanks, Mandy.
Thank you.
Okay, and your next question comes from Robert Grindle from Deutsche Bank. Please go ahead, you're live in the call.
Yeah, hi there. Good morning. A question for me on consumer broadband. The churn seems to have just tweaked up a bit in the quarter, a bit more than what looks like is the normal seasonality. Is that a COVID backlog thing or something else? I did see PlusNet complaints spiked a bit in the latest Ofcom data. Also, do you think there's any early impact on the price rises you're planning? There has been some press around that. Even got into the FT last weekend. So, yes, a comment around consumer broadband churn, please.
Yeah, Robert, I'll get Mark to talk about the churn and PlusNet and the price rises. Just one comment, though, even more generally. I mean, challenging times, but I have to say, the customer feedback on consumer augurs really well for the future. The level of satisfaction is growing. The NPS is growing. Mark and his team have done a fantastic job in delivering for the customer in these very difficult circumstances. We talked about the demands are much higher. So I think it all goes extremely well. And actually, some of the customer profile we've now got, I think, is very encouraging, notwithstanding your point about a little change in churn. But I'll let Mark give his perspective on that.
Yeah, thanks, Philip. Yeah, nothing to get concerned about. It's a small tweak up. Our trading performance has actually, over the last couple of quarters, been very, very strong on all of our brands and net additions on strategic networks like Full Fibre and 5G, very strong. So I'm actually really pleased with the trading performance. We have, as you can see in the ARPU figures, invested a little bit more to improve our competitiveness, and that has helped the base growth. you're right on PassNet. We have had some issues we've been dealing with, but the team have got that under control now. We can start to see the complaints coming down and the customer satisfaction improving, and confident that this trend is set to continue, because the satisfaction results we're seeing is all pointing to a much more stable base and a happier base for the future as we go into next year. So, yes, we're battling with another quarter, probably Q4, with some more COVID headwinds, all the things we know about. But as we move into next year, I'm very confident of the growth trajectory we're going to start seeing. On the price notifications point you also raised, we only just started the notifications, actually, so they're probably too early to say. We started notifying the EE-based, BT-based starts in volume next week. So, but no, from the customers, and it's well north of a million that we've already notified, no significant impact there, and it's pretty standard practice on the mobile side, and I'm not anticipating any big issues on the fixed side either.
Thanks, Beth.
Thanks, Robert. Thanks, Mark.
Thank you. And your next question comes from Charlotte Perfect from Arete Research. Please go ahead. You're live in the call.
Hello. Hi. Thank you. My question is quite a long-dated question in terms of, I mean, of course, there's a lot of focus around the 20 million footprint and the regulatory enablers for that. Just trying to get a sense of how things will look, and it builds on John's question from earlier, actually, how things will look outside of your core footprint where AltNet builds and you don't. I think you previously mentioned that you are potentially open to partnering with AltNets on build in more rural areas. But also a question around consumer and whether consumer would wholesale from other CPs where they have fibre and where you don't. Thank you.
Yeah, Charlotte, thanks for the question. I mean, you're right to point it out. You know, we have a 20 million footprint planned over the next few years. There will be places where we don't get before someone else gets. And so we need to think through how we handle that. I guess I'll just point out one other thing. In terms of the way most of the volume will go, it will go into places which are, you know, competitive. I think we're going to see the vast majority of build in places that are economically attractive. And, you know, there is this opportunity in the cities, by the way, of course, which all of us building fibre will go for. So I think, you know, there's a strong recognition that there is, you know, one player who has in cities some speed advantages today. So I think there's huge opportunities for Openreach and others to build in those cities and get some good outcomes there. So I think, again, to my earlier point, I feel really good about Openreach's ability to compete in those areas and deliver for all its customers, Sky, Vodafone, TalkTalk, and obviously BT Retail as well, right? So I'm confident about that. I think as time progresses and we see how things evolve, I think it's possible, and we remain open-minded about, you know, BT Consumer and BT Retail extending its partnership with other people. But I think we just need to get going on post the WSTMR and see how things play out. But again, I would feel that BT and Openreach has a clear plan, and is, I think there's enough indication of the success of Openreach now on the build and also on the connection. So I'm really pleased with it. So we're open-minded. We'll see how it goes. I can see a situation in 10 years' time where it is possible we will be buying from other people, but there also might be consolidation in those other people at some stage as well, because not all will be successful. Thanks, Charlotte.
Thank you.
Thank you. And your next question comes from Akhil Dattani from JP Morgan. Please go ahead. You're live in the call.
Hi, morning. Just a couple of clarifications, please, Philip. You obviously talked a lot about the WSTMR. I just wanted to really clarify exactly what you're expecting us to get out of it, because you've obviously talked a lot about the fair bet and returns. So do you actually think that Ofcom will come out and explicitly talk to the ranges you've said around returns? We actually get hard numbers rather than rhetoric. And linked to that, you said one of the harder things is going to be the long-term contracts, and that might be more of a challenge. If that's the case, how do you think about your ability to definitively have confidence that you'll deliver the returns you want when there will be overbuilders out there and you're not able to lock in your CPEs and protect your investments for future returns? And then the only other quick clarification, just a prior question I just wanted to understand is, I think the prior question we were talking about declines now and then the recovery. It's a quick question on consumer, just to understand why the fixed line and mobile was falling 6-7%. It seems quite a bit sharper than the peer declines we're seeing. So just any colour on the declines would be really useful. Thanks.
Okay, well, thanks for that. That's, Mark can handle those consumer questions in a minute, and I'll get Catherine to sort of answer the substantive part of your question on what we expect and what we'd like. I mean, my general answer just is to say on the build, it's a general point. Don't underestimate how difficult it is to build a full fibre network at pace, at a very high quality, at a acceptable cost profile, and particularly in those areas that are not as straightforward as you know the very very easy, straightforward urban area. So that's the first thing. Don't forget that Clive and his team have been testing and modelling and trying and practicing the exercise of building, you know, what is not an insignificant engineering exercise. So you know, it's all very well talking about it, but actually doing it, I got out myself many times to see it being done. It's not as straightforward as everyone would hope or expect. And the great news for BT and specifically Openreach is that they've spent a lot of time refining it, and I think they've got very, very good at it. With one, you know, challenge left, which is provisioning. But that provisioning challenge is very significant for Openreach, but it's not unique to them. So I think you've got to remember that as by way of background. So, you know, what we're saying back into the WSMR is we want to make sure that the articulation they put in place encourages the right outcomes for everybody, not just BT, because my aim is, yes, I want to do right by BT and do right by our shareholders. I have to, that's my job. But I'm also keen to make sure the country gets great digital infrastructure, both in fibre and 5G, because that's what we all need. And I want to make sure that we play our part in that, but we can't if the circumstances or the regulatory framework prevent us from making the decisions that we think we should. So let me. I hope that makes sense to you. Let me get Catherine to make some comments on your specific question, then we'll go to Mark to answer the consumer points.
Thanks for that. Hi, Akhil. It's interesting on this. I mean, there are different layers, if you like, of specificity that Ofcom can provide on the question of the fair debt and how it will assess our returns. And if you like, the sort of top layer is the layer of sort of principle, that they can be very clear what principles they're going to follow. And I think you can see that they have been pretty clear about that. They've been very consistent in saying that they will honour the fair debt. They've been very consistent in saying what they think the fair debt means, in the sense that they need to leave upside in play that will compensate us for the downside risk we see at the time we make the investment decision. Not only have they been consistent in that, you've seen Melanie in her recent FTTH speech, you know, confirming that as the new chief exec of Ofcom, she also believes that fibre investment must be a fair bet, and she'd a little bit more to unpack how she sees that principle. So all of that's good, and we're very confident they will say that in their documents again, because they've said it consistently. And then the next layer of detail that they can go to, which we're very keen to see them go to, is the layer of sort of methodology. You know, what do those principles mean in practice? And in respect to the fair bet, that really collapses to two areas. One is their approach to calculating our weighted average cost of capital for the fibre build, and there is their approach to assessing that premium, if you like, that uplift on top of the cost of capital that they need to leave in play to compensate us for the downside risk that we are taking. And again, I'm hopeful that they will specify their methodology, you know, how they will approach those calculations in the document. Not least for the reason that Philip sets out. It's not only important for BT
but that is important for everybody investing in fibre. And it's important so that people have a reasonable ability to predict where, when, and how Ofcom will intervene with its regulations. So I think that's quite likely. And it would be great also if they could say in that sort of methodological approach the kinds of risk that they would expect to see us compensated for if they do come in and impose further regulation of our fibre products. And then, of course, the final level of detail that they could get to is numbers. They could actually tell us, you know, what level of return in numbers they would be content for us to earn, or indeed in numbers, you know, what the premium over the WACC is that they would be content for us to earn before they came in and regulated, and that they would leave in play with their regulation. And I think that's harder for them. That's harder for them because it's, you know, it's difficult, I think, for the regulator to make those kinds of calculations, especially about the premium over the WACC. It would be great if they did, and it would be great to have that level of certainty. But I think it's also worth saying that, you know, there are plenty of people who are experienced managers and indeed experienced investors in regulated businesses who are used to not getting clarity on the numbers, but actually getting clarity on the methodology and the approach and using that to get confidence about investment decisions. So I think that's probably all I'd say at this stage.
Thanks, Catherine. Hope that's okay, Akhil. Mark, do you want to just handle the specific consumer questions?
Yeah, let me start with fixed, because I think it's important to split out the fixed business and the mobile business within consumer. I think if we start with fixed, I think it's helpful to remind everyone on the call that this year isn't just a year where we're dealing with COVID impact, but it was also a year where we said we would invest a lot more than we have done to lean into the fairness agenda and deal with a lot of the issues that were impacting us on bump book, back book, customer loyalty, dissatisfaction, complaints, etc. So there's been investments there that have impacted ARPU, but do set us up in a much better way for the future as we look into the next financial year, and I'll come on to that. So we've been migrating copper customers to fibre. We've been pricing down those copper customers that aren't in fibre areas. We've been introducing out-of-contract price caps to customers, millions of customers, and leading into best tariff notifications, end of contract notifications, and so on. Whilst we've also been investing more in service, onshore and service, bringing the fixed business into retail, being much more proactive about the service that we give our customers, supporting vulnerable customers through the COVID period. And we have also invested a little bit more to sharpen up our pricing to be more competitive, particularly on building a more strategic base of full fibre FTTP. And we've seen in the results a record number of full fibre connections there and really high satisfaction levels from our customers with those products. So there's all those dynamics going on within the fixed ARPU, but I'm confident we've got the equation right between volume and value, and I'm really happy with the fact that we have invested in the fairness agenda and significantly closed the loyalty gap that we had before, which I touched on in the investor briefing, and I think that sets us up really well for the future, and I'll come on to that. In mobile, very different story, and we don't split out the E unit within consumer for you all, so I can understand why you're asking the questions. When I look at the E unit performance versus peers, I'm confident it's performing you know, pretty consistently with peers both here and elsewhere. It's important to remind everyone we are a big player in the handset market. We tend to have the more valuable handset customers on our base, so any shifts in the handset market impact us more than some of the smaller, more online SIM-only digital players. And when retail is closed, and we saw this in the first lockdown, we're seeing it in this lockdown, it does reduce the size of the handset market. So we can see the handset market being more or less a million or so transactions down, and of course the growth in SIM-only, so that impacts us. We're seeing handset customers hold on to their handsets for a bit longer. The replacement cycle, we think this year, is about 4 or 5 months longer than last time. We've also, as a reminder, we've exited Dixon's car phone, so that gives us short-term impact, but that's beneficial for us in the long term. And because we have the more valuable customers who tend to travel a bit more, we are impacted a bit more, I think, on roaming out of bundle than others as well. And of course, retail being closed during the quarter we're in, we expect these trends to continue. But I think looking forward, what does all of this mean? We've got a much healthier base to build from. Record numbers of full fiber, 5G ready base north of 2 million. We've got the pricing model, which we reminded you, 25% of our customers on the CPI plus this year. There's going to be more or less three times that amount in 12 months' time going through the CPI plus, and we see a slightly more inflationary environment as well. We're building great differentiation with Halo 3 Plus and EE Network with its partners. We do see the restrictions opening up for retail, pubs and clubs, roaming coming back. We've got a much better service platform in terms of churn, NPS, trading performance, and a healthier base to build from. So about the future, a few headwinds during the next few months, but once we're through Q4, I think we're in a much better place and a more sustainable base to build from.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks, Akhil.
Thank you.
Thank you. And your next question comes from David Wright from Bank of America. Please go ahead. You're live in the call.
Hi, David.
Well, Philip, yes, sir, I'm here just as ever, struggling with needs. Actually, a lot of my question was just answered very interestingly on consumer and the outlook for consumer that is impacted by very high exposure to handsets. I guess, does that mean, as we see this wider shift towards digitalization of the industry and maybe a reduced retail store footprint with more online sales supporting reduced commissions and better margins, but are you guys perhaps a little hampered in that process if you're more reliant on the handsets and you perhaps less able to moderate the retail store footprint, or is there a way you can still try and shift more of your sales to online? And I would maybe be interested if you could give the current percentage of sales you currently manage online within retail mobile. Thank you.
David, I might get Mark just to answer most of that, but I'd just give you one quick point is it's all about getting the balance right. And the retail stores for us are actually a very, very important asset, and we'll always optimise it, but I'll let Mark just give you the specifics, but unfortunately can't give you the breakdown. But go on, Mark.
Yeah, thanks for that. Yeah, I think that's right. It's all about the balance, the stores we know, and we saw this after the first lockdown opened up. There's a huge demographic that do prefer shopping in retail than other channels, and 55 years and over, and they're a very, very valuable part of the market. So we saw a massive sort of pent up demand from that group coming back to buy not just handsets, but tablets and smart home accessories and broadband and TV, sport, all the other stuff we sell as well. So I still believe retail is going to be reasonably vibrant, I think, for the telco sector. The role of the stores, we've certainly seen an evolution in how our stores are performing, and in many cases now we've been operating them. It's obviously been very lumpy with the lockdowns, but as always, micro hyper local contact centres. And there are a number of services that you can only really get still in a store. I mean, when the world gets moving again and we're all sort of travelling in and out of offices perhaps less frequently and handsets break down, a third of customers every year break their handsets, smash their screens, an instant repair or same day, next day repair is a vital service to keep you connected. As just one example, instant SIM swaps, all of these kind of things that a physical presence really helps you with. And the other part we're evolving to is effectively a store that comes to you through our home tech experts as well. So, I consider those as much retail stores as physical retail stores, in the sense that there's a mobile store that moves to our customers' homes or offices and gets them set up. So I think the role of retail, of course, is going to evolve. We're pretty clear, I think, we'll see less stores in the future. The role will certainly evolve. But they are really, really important for convergence, for bundling, digital sales. I'm not going to give you the exact number, but massively up during the Christmas period, and we've got more and more digital capability rolling out that's making it easier for us to cross sell and serve our customers. and digital satisfaction on our brands is very high, with a lot of investment going in there as well. So I don't see it as a disadvantage for us. It's, you know, these are market trends and customer trends we need to adjust to, but I'd much rather be adjusting to those trends and customer needs with a fantastic retail estate, home tech experts that are nationwide, as well as a really strong digital channel, tele-channel, and a fantastic team nationwide. And you know, that means we can adjust and support customers better than anybody else from our sector.
Thanks. And David, one other thing. Just, I mean, you know, as Mark says, we'll optimise it. It'll evolve in terms of retail estate. But, you know, it being closed clearly gives opportunities to the value of it. And as Mark says, they've got a real role to play. They've added a lot of value. And so, as an example, your Halo 3 Plus, we're launching it now. I mean, you can go into a store and walk out with it and be connected straight away. I mean, there are lots of other opportunities of using the sort of micro service approach, that, you know, very local, hyper-local activity that Mark talked about. So we're excited about it, but obviously we'll also be very thoughtful about how it evolves over time. Right, thanks a lot, David.
Thank you. And your next question comes from C.E. Hay from Citi. Please go ahead. You're live in the call.
Thank you very much for taking the question. Just to have a follow-up on consumers, I appreciate the colors on the trends in consumers going forward. Just want to ask on the cost side, EBITDA is down 13% this quarter just because of the top-line pressure. And I think that's potentially offset to some extent by COVID-related savings. And just now we talk, enterprise talk about the potential higher marketing spending on SMEs. So on consumer as well, given that you're pushing for FTTP and 5G, should we anticipate more investments to come through post-lockdown? So overall, we think about consumer is improvement in the top-line trends, and maybe less so on the EBITDA side because of higher costs. And also, if I may, just want to get your views about your 5G and how, and maybe some comments on how do you see 5G tariffs being take up, and whether you think there could be opportunities to monetize this. Thank you very much.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. I'll get Simon to just give you his perspective on your cost type question. Very quickly on 5G. I mean, we're really excited about what we're doing on 5G. I mean, you know, we always said we would maintain our market leadership, you know, that we had on 4G, and I think you can see the evidence here. The 5G rollout continues at pace, and there's encouraging demand. Obviously, the iPhone 12 launch from Apple was hugely important, and again, without sharing loads of detail, I think we should feel very pleased with the outcome of that. And you know, in market share terms, I think we've performed very strongly. So I think there are lots of good indicators for 5G, and we are selling, you know, a combined package of 5G associated activities, which I think are helpful and positive. I'm hopeful again that the 5G market continues to have as much premium as we possibly can in the consumer market, but we'll see how the market plays out. We just need to be as competitive as we possibly can, but our propositions are the best in the marketplace, no question. And our coverage is better than anybody else's. So that will keep happening. I think the big thing about 5G is enterprise. I think, you know, and Rob and I have talked about this already. I think we're really excited about how we can use 5G in the enterprise space to deliver things that people just can't get today. And the campus example that I used today at Warwick University, you know, is just a sort of taste of that. We've got some others as well. So we'll be bringing you back. Rob and I will bring back to you more examples out on 5G. But it's still early days, obviously, as we're building out the network. Simon, do you want to answer the cost type question?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, you are absolutely right, Stevie, that we are investing to drive differentiation and drive improved customer experience in consumer as we are across the group. And we are also investing to drive take-up of ever better connectivity, both fixed and mobile, which there's a, you know, significant receptivity amongst our customers. And as Mark described, we do, you know, see revenue momentum as we move forward through a combination of the strong base we've built, the take-up of improved connectivity products and the pricing policy we're implementing. Yes, we would invest, you know, to drive that, and we'll continue to do so, but we'll be able to mitigate some of that investment through continued delivery of our cost transformation program. We've got, you know, significant continued opportunities to move more of our customer journeys to be straight through, to be, you know, fully digital. We've made huge strides in improving the productivity of our contact center operations, having brought them all back to the UK. We are always challenging every element of the fixed cost base that sits across the group and is carried in consumer. So all of that will give us leverage to continue to improve our cost productivity.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. And your next question comes from Carl Murdoch-Smith from Berenberg. Please go ahead, you're live in the call.
Hi, thanks very much. I'd like to ask about the risk of industrial action by union members. I think the ballot results of a small number of open ranks engineering on strike action is actually due very shortly. How are talks going with the CWU more broadly? And should we be preparing ourselves for headlines of strike action? Thanks.
Yeah, Carl, thank you. I'm going to ask Alison Wilcox to make a comment on this and give you her perspective. I mean, the first thing I'd say is, you know, we actually have, you know, a really constructive, positive relationship with both our unions, actually. You know, many, many of our colleagues are members. And, you know, we encourage genuinely any dialogue with our staff through any channel. And, you know, we set up this all-colleague board, for example. So we've got lots of different channels by which we can communicate and hear from our colleagues. And the union is really, really, really important to that. So inevitably, you know, we're transforming and modernizing and changing BT to make it a much better BT for the future. And when you have that level of change, inevitably, it won't suit everybody's personal aspirations perfectly. It's just, you know, and one of the biggest things, Carl, that we're doing here is, you know, we're effectively moving from 300 locations in the UK to 30. I mean, you know, just think of the potential upheaval of that. And there are going to be people who are dislocated as a result of that and find their circumstances changing on them that doesn't meet their overall objectives. So it's never straightforward. And the way we're approaching it is to listen very, very carefully, hear people, and in those circumstances where we can't meet people's objectives or aspirations or needs, treat with great care and handle things very professionally and very elegantly. And that's what Alison is leading on behalf of the whole company. Does it mean we agree everything? Of course not. Is it possible that the union get very disappointed in some of the implications for a very small number of people? Possibly. But again, the main message to you, Carl, is the changes we're making are to improve and modernise BT, make it much better, and under all circumstances, the vast, vast majority, it's the high 90% of people, are going to be better off as a result of what we do. So, Alison, do you want to give your perspective on the specific question around the CWU?
Sure. Yes, of course. Then, hi, Carl. Nice to hear from you. I won't add to the context because Philip has captured that perfectly, actually. And in particular, the fact that we have long-standing, very good and constructive relationships with the unions that we work with. So we talk to them all the time, we walk every step of this road with them, and we consider that to be absolutely in our interest, but also in the interest of our people too. So we're keeping very close to this. As you probably know, Carl, in December, so 10th of December, the CCU announced the result of a consultative ballot for industrial action, and they have a turnout of 74%, just over that actually, and a yes vote of just about 98%. Now, important to consider that that was not a ballot for industrial action, it was a ballot asking their membership whether they would be prepared to support that. And therefore, you know, to some degree, that particular ballot was, you know, didn't indicate anything particularly concrete, but we do take the results of that very seriously, because what it tells us is that we have a significant number of our people who are anxious, concerned, and uncertain about the future, I think. So we're doubling down our efforts to make sure that both directly with our people, but also with the unions, that we continue to explain the case for change. And as Philip says, that we take great care in doing that and also in reassuring people that we will go to every effort to try to reskill people whose jobs are at risk as much as we can. There's a smaller CWU ballot running at the moment, which is specifically for industrial action. That is associated with around about 170 repayment engineers in Openreach. So these are engineers who are moving or repairing the network for third parties. And the outcome of that is due to be announced around about lunchtime today. It's possible that may result in industrial action during February, and we're standing by to understand what comes out of that. But our overall approach and strategy and commitment to working with the trade unions as well as with our people is firm.
That's interesting.
Thanks, Carl. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And your next question comes from Jerry Dellis from Jefferies. Please go ahead. You're live in the call.
Yes, good morning. Thank you for taking my questions. Just coming back, I'm afraid, to Ofcom and the FAIRB Act, and knowing this statement in particular on the 3rd of December. So, Philip, earlier on you said that really what matters is the when and how of how Ofcom intends to regulate. You'd like that to be written down in the final Ofcom statement. What Melanie said on the 3rd of December was that there should be some sort of premium for faster services and that the investment period might be a relatively long one. But she certainly didn't commit to a particular nominal figure. She didn't commit to a methodology for WACC calculation. And the time frame for these Ofcom reviews is formally 5 years. So I realise that the question's been asked, but I wonder if you could just clarify what they could really spell out that would really address all of the concerns and meet all of the objectives that you stated earlier in terms of a visible timetable that's a long one and at least a clear methodology for cost of capital. And then linked to that, if you don't get what you consider to be an acceptable outcome, I mean, what happens there? You've talked about geographical fibre build a couple of times on this call. So would it be a situation of essentially easing off on the rural fibre build, and what would be the implication for your CapEx budget, please?
Yeah. Jerry, thanks. I'll get Simon and Catherine just to chip in as well here. First, I think the speech that Melanie made was actually very encouraging, right? And I think, you know, she said a number of things there about recognising the long-term nature, recognising the premium, as you rightly say, and actually she intimated and indeed said, you know, the focus isn't the returns we're making, which is encouraging, right? The focus is a fast build and a good customer outcome at good prices, good value for money. So that outcome-based approach is really, really good, and we're hopeful that's going to see its way into the documentation and not more unhelpful things like blanket statements of as long as there's good competition, which is open to a whole host of misinterpretations or different points of view. So I think it's actually the intent and the sentiment in the speech is exactly what we wanted to hear. The question is, and you're driving at it quite rightly, is what is written in the document that is specific enough to give us the reassurance? So an example, and Simon mentioned it, is two charge controls is essential. Three would be good, because that recognises the length of it. A clear terminology of how they would look at returns and how they would consider regulation in terms of calculations and numbers around WACC and other things would be extremely helpful. So I'll get Simon and Catherine just to comment on the specifics of what we'd like to see, but let me just give you an answer to your don't get question. I think we will, the regulatory framework that gets issued, I think, will absolutely underline our desire and our plan to build this package of 20 million hertz. I think it does, the profile of it, and particularly around the rural build, but also the sequence
of the rural versus urban build, but also therefore and also the pace of it is very dependent on the detail of the works. So it's not impossible that certain parts of the build could be very backloaded. And since we're in mid to late 2020s, it wouldn't be in the country's interest to build some of the rural things right at the end. But if that was the sensible thing to do for our shareholders, given we've had 3 years to write this document and it then becomes cast in stone, that's what we might choose to do. So I hope, you know, again, we don't know, we need to see it, but what I'm reassuring people of, we'll be very, very thoughtful as a company as to where we put this money to work based on what we see from the regulator ultimately to a large degree governs how we think about this fibre investment. Simon, do you want to add anything or Catherine on the specifics of what we could hope for in terms of the document on around the fair bet?
Yeah, Philip, let me say what I think we would ideally need, and then if I may, Catherine, perhaps from a regulatory perspective, talk about the various options. I mean, very specifically, we need clarity on the time period before which Ofcom would impose regulatory prices. As you know, we think 3 price control periods, which is broadly akin to the payback, would be appropriate, and certainly 2 would be the minimum. Secondly, we need clarity on the method through which Ofcom would determine the WACC for this project at the point we make the investment decision. And ideally, we'd like to see that translated into a clear number, but clarity on the method such that all investors can then, you know, impute what the number would likely be. And then thirdly, clarity on the threshold over that cost of capital before which the regulator would intervene, such that we can keep upside to compensate for downside. And then finally, clarity on the method through which Ofcom would calculate the depreciation of that investment for the purposes of setting regulatory prices. And we think that needs to be some form of economic CAGR. So those are the 4 specific things. Catherine, do you want to just address the different regulatory tools that could be done to bring that clarity?
Happy to do that, Simon. There are different things that can be done here. We've talked about them, I think, already. Very, very helpful, I think, for Ofcom to be clear about the principles behind all of that. We would like them, we're very keen for them, and I think they understand this, to set out their methodological approach in their documents. The formulae that they would use, the risks that they would take into account, in particular on WACC and the calculation of the premium. We think that is possible. It's not unduly tying their hands in future, and it wouldn't only give helpful clarity and predictability to us, but also crucially, I think, to other fibre investors, and I think that matters to them. Similarly, in terms of clarity on their approach to depreciation, I think absolutely Ofcom can give clarity on this. And in fact, if you look back at some previous Ofcom approaches to depreciation in charge controls, you'll see, for example, that they've used an annuity approach to depreciation. That might well be appropriate here because it had the effect of, in a sense, matching cost recovery profiles to the demand profile for the service. That's not unreasonable. And that would give us some assurance, for example, that when regulation kicks in, we will be able to recover the cost that was still outstanding for recovery at that point, given that perhaps demand had taken a little bit of time to ramp up for the service. And I think all of that is perfectly doable. It's the kind of thing that Ofcom has done in the past. We would like them to give clarity about the numbers. That would give us an extra degree of certainty going forward, but I think really the non-negotiable here is clarity on the methodology. The only other thing I would say, which we haven't talked about so far, is that obviously our ability to earn a decent return on our fibre investment is obviously partly about when Ofcom intervenes with further regulation of fibre pricing and how they might do that. But it's also about the freedom that Philip was talking about before for BT and in particular Openreach to compete fairly in the market where in fact Ofcom isn't going to regulate but where we face effective competition. So it's very important, I think, when we're thinking about our ability to earn a return, to think about those two halves, both the question about when and how Ofcom will regulate, but also the extent to which it gives us freedom to compete fairly in the market. And as Philip said, we are optimistic that the document will say something that we can live with, but we will be watching that wording very carefully indeed.
Great, thank you. I hope that's okay, Jerry.
Thank you very much.
And your next question comes from James Ratzer from New Street Research. Please go ahead, you're live in the call.
Hi, James.
Yes, good morning. Hi, everybody. Had a question going back to the topic of open reach physical line connections, please, and the potential kind of threat from some of the fibre overbuilders. I mean, looking at the numbers nationally, it seems as if, you know, so far that's having a negligible effect on your business, really. But just would love to hear a bit more about kind of what you're seeing at a regional level, you know, say in areas like maybe Coventry, Milton Keynes, Peterborough, where City Fibre has been in the market for a bit longer, or some of the suburbs in London where Hyper Optic has been present for longer. What kind of pressure, if any, are you seeing on your open reach line connections in those areas?
Yeah, sure, James. Look, Clive can give you his thoughts on that. First, again, just to repeat the point before, you know, given our scale, we do expect over the next, you know, decade to see some line losses, but Clive and I and many others are focused on minimising that number and keeping it as small as possible. So, Clive, do you want to give your thoughts on the specifics around where we've gone with where we see other competition?
Yeah, sure. Thank you very much for the question, James. Look, as internet and television media extend their footprint, we will see some line losses, right? Where television media have a big footprint of their own today, particularly their HFC footprint, as our sales ramp up on our urban FTTP, I would expect for our share to grow, right? So things are going to be different in different areas. If you look at the Milton Keynes and the provinces, there isn't a massive difference today in the rate of line losses, but this is all about, you know, figuring out what it's going to look like into the future. Now, one point I do want to register with you now, though, James, is an understanding that right now, not all of the customers of our FTTP have digital voice available for their customers. So there is a slight fluttering in the numbers, because sometimes when one of our CPs put a customer of theirs on the FTTP, they maintain the WLR line in order to offer traditional PSTN voice. So there's some of that sort of hidden in the numbers, and that will unwind over time. Those numbers are not enormous, but it is something, you know, just to point out to you.
Thanks, Clive.
Clive, it just may be worth adding that much of that are actually BTCPs, and therefore, from an overall group perspective, it's not a significant financial impact.
That's a good add. From the group perspective, it makes almost no difference at all on it. And that's an important point. Thank you, Simon.
And it also is a contributor to some of the margin pressure we described earlier on consumer.
Yeah, correct.
Thanks, James.
And your next question comes from Adam Fox-Rumley from HSBC. Please go ahead, you're live in the call.
Hi, Adam. You're not a question, I believe.
Okay, I'll try and make it a good one. I wondered if you could give us an update on the process re-engineering at BT. It really highlighted you wanted to address after your 100 days, and I wonder if the restructuring that was announced recently suggests the progress has been a bit slower than you'd hoped there, or whether it's just that different things need to happen now. And then relating to that slightly in the reorganisation, I wondered if you needed to find a new head of corporate strategy. It strikes me that Simon's got quite a lot of things on his plate already, and so I wonder if you needed that one. Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, Adam, good questions, Adam.
But I mean, firstly, you know, on Simon, I mean, he's not that busy particularly. So I think him taking on a bit more is well within his capability. And I say it slightly tongue-in-cheek, but I mean, if there's somebody who, you know, Simon is an ex-McKinsey partner, by the way. I don't know if you knew that. So I'm very comfortable and confident that Simon and I can plot forward the BT group strategy. So I'm very happy with that, by the way. So, but on your other more substantive question, I think it's an important one. If we're not sort of articulating the numbers on the pure cost savings from transformation and simplification, and but in the last quarter we talked about the 352 million of run rate savings we'd already achieved. And I think that indicates that we got off to a good start, and we'll be updating at our full year results the further numbers on that particular initiative. So I think I'm actually pleased with that. What I'm less pleased with, it's just the nature of the beast, is the effort to modernise, reorganise, re-engineer, restructure, and make BT better. It's just very, very difficult. And it is, as I've always said, it's going to take a fair few years to do that. We are making progress. But of course I'd like to go faster. Everybody would like to go faster. But you just got to work your way through it. And there are steps that have to be taken around simplification of IT, both in terms of architecture, but applications and number of applications, and also just dealing with processes. But there are little snippets of green shoots. You know, the customer satisfaction numbers I referred to as being, basically as higher than they've ever been across the company, with a few exceptions, inevitably, because we measure it in every single segment. It's down to a number of things, but there is a few examples where customer journeys and digital experiences and zero touch and new applications are generating better customer outcomes, which is the whole point. And internally, we're doing things that are making life easier by using technology. I mean, financial systems and support, for example, we're having a massive upgrade and change there. So I don't want to get this wrong, but it's really, really important. I don't want people to feel like we're not achieving what I want. It's just we're not going as fast as anyone would like. So again, having said that, as harmony arises, it just adds a level of capability and skills and experience and allows us to learn from other places. And Harmeen's worked in the banking sector, which is a massive challenge away from legacy. She worked in travel, which is massive, e-commerce, online. And obviously she knows the telecoms market that's been in the last 7 years at Bharti Airtel. In a market that's very mobile driven. I don't mean mobile device or handset. I mean just the whole thing is mobile app digital. So I think we add that to our brilliant credentials that we already have in Howard's team as an example where we know what we're doing on the network side. We've got a complicated estate to sort out from the IT and digital side. So the combination of frankly Howard and Harmeen, plus hopefully with a little bit of help from me and other members of the exec team working really closely together, augurs well for that. But it's a long journey, and I just want to be realistic about it. This is it's going to take us at least 5 years to get to the point where we start to feel like we're in a really, really good place. So it's a long old haul, but we're making okay progress.
All right, thanks very much.
I think we're on to our last question, I believe. Is that right?
You are, yes, and it's from Polo Tang from UBS. Please go ahead, you're live in the call.
Hi, Polo.
Hi, thanks for taking the question. I joined the call late, so apologies if you've answered part of this question already. But my question was really around competition from Sky, because they seem to be getting more aggressive in terms of the mobile market, and they're also going to start targeting the SME broadband market. So can you maybe just talk through what you're seeing in terms of competitive dynamics in the consumer space and how you think about the impact on the SME market from Sky? Thanks.
Yeah, I mean, Paolo, good point. I think everybody knows it's extremely competitive, right? And so wherever you look, whether in fiber build or even 5G, for example, you know, that there are multiple players spending, you know, a lot of money competing in this market, and I guess there are a lot of very powerful, very good companies, and the market's changing in some of the consolidation moves we've seen. So our expectation is that this competition is going to continue, and which is why we need to make sure we're fit for the fight, right? And that fitness is about the point Adam was asking about modernizing, re-engineering and reorganizing and making BT a better company. But it's also, more importantly, on that top of that platform of new BT, delivering customer propositions and services and an experience which are second to none. And the reason I answer the question with that sort of intro is, you know, the BT sort of service proposition and product development is beginning to show some real traction. And we've got to work out, you know, where we can differentiate. And you'll have noticed, you know, you can probably tell, I know you can tell that the consumer metrics, apart from the ARPU, which and the mobile roaming and the impact on BT Sport, from a customer base point of view, are, you know, positive. And so Mark's team are doing a great job of competing really effectively. And there's a lot of only BT. Only BT can offer you complete Wi-Fi with a Wi-Fi guarantee in every room. Only BT can offer you Halo 3 Plus, which is a product you can buy today and connect today and guarantees your connection. It's a UK first. So expect more of those things because of what you said. Sky and Vodafone and TalkTalk and Virgin and O2, they're all coming into the marketplace with new ideas and new thoughts. And you mentioned the mobile point for Sky and their foray into SME. We fully expect those things. But as long as there's a level playing field and the regulatory framework isn't skewed against BT, BT's assets are really, really strong. You know, we've got the best fixed network. We've got the best mobile network. By definition, that gives us the opportunity for the best converged network, a la Halo 3 Plus, and the things that are going to appear in the SME market by definition following that, as Rob gets his arms around the business. Says that we've got superb assets and we've got, you know, 100,000 people who have demonstrated they can deliver fantastic stuff for customers in the way I described. So we're ready for that competitive battle. We are not complacent, and we are well aware of other people doing very good things. But I'm confident over the next few years we'll do better than that. And I think you'll see us offering really, really strong propositions into the marketplace that differentiate us and allow us to make a decent return and get up to that 7.9 billion EBITDA that I talked about in 2023. So, Paula, with that, I think thank you for that question. I really appreciate it. I think we're going to close the call, Mark.
Yes, Philip, thank you very much for everyone's time. And if you've got any follow-up, please let me or any of the team know. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Philip. Thank you, Mark. Everyone, that does conclude your conference call for today. You may now disconnect. Thank you for joining. Enjoy the rest of your day.